My name is Arianis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at New York University, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I'm joined by a very, very special guest, Bishop James Massa, an auxiliary bishop in Brooklyn for the Archdiocese of the Catholic Church, and as well as the former executive director of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Secretariat for Ecumenical and Interreligious Dialogue. For those who aren't as familiar with the inner workings of the Catholic Church, he is the man who recently organized the Pope's Interfaith event in New York City in the Pope's recent trip, and has a lot to teach us about the Catholic Church and their approach to interfaith work. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Bishop James Massa from the Archdiocese of Brooklyn, and by Drea. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Andrea Maihara. I am a senior at NYU studying politics and food studies, and I'm a part of the Multifaith Advisory Council.
So, Bishop Massa, I know we were just talking about how you mentioned you cut your teeth doing interfaith within the Catholic Church. And yep. So I'm sure to many of our listeners and to me as an outsider to the church, when I think of the church, I don't think of the interfaith arm. It's not like the first thing I think of. So maybe you could explain to us a little bit what does that mean? What were the types of things you were doing? Anything like that to give us some context?
Sure. I was the executive director of the Secretariat for Ecumenical and Interreligious Affairs in Washington for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So it's a bit of a mouthful, but
yeah.
But it's basically the kind of like the headquarters of the Catholic leadership in the United States, right near Catholic University in Northwest Washington. Basically, we coordinated out of that office a whole series of dialogues with Christian groups and then with representatives of other religions, non-Christian religions, mm-hmm. if you will. So we had a set of dialogues, for example, with Episcopalians, another set with Lutherans, another set of dialogues with Presbyterians. Each of these are different branches of the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. And the goal of those dialogues is to remove the obstacles to unity mm-hmm. so that we can profess the faith in common and fully participate in each other's worship services. Interreligious dialogue is something different. That has to do with basically working together with other religions on social issues, addressing social problems like racism, anti-Semitism, giving a common witness to peace, and you know, other modes of collaboration. One of the key goals is mutual understanding, mm-hmm. understanding the other. Interreligious dialogue is now become particularly pressing in the mm-hmm. world today
yeah.
because of all of the religious conflicts, so-called religious conflicts around the world, or the violence that is motivated by religious ideologies. So that was a wonderful work. This, if I can put it in some historical context,
yeah.
the Catholic Church has been engaged in these two types of dialogues now for about 50 years.
Right.
Since the end of a famous meeting that took place in Rome over mm-hmm. the course of 4 years, gathering all of the leaders of the Catholic Church, the bishops, together in Rome every fall between 1962 and 1965. It was called the Second Vatican Council.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Many Catholics remember it
mm-hmm.
because it changed our style of worship
yeah.
from the historic Latin Mass and using Gregorian chant to celebrating public worship in the vernacular, in
mm-hmm.
the language of the people.
Right.
But there were many other achievements of the Second Vatican Council, and one of them really was to open up avenues of dialogue with other Christians and with the members of other religions. One of the themes of the Second Vatican Council is that the Catholic Church has to be more engaged with the needs of contemporary men and women. And so much of that has to do with today with, understanding the other.
Mm.
The other's culture, the other's religion, the other's politics. And so dialogue, interfaith dialogue, as it's often called, really was an outgrowth of the Second Vatican Council. Mm.
And I know that kind of within, for people who are outsiders to the Catholic Church, I have heard people in the Catholic Church reference Vatican II probably more than anything else in the Catholic Church, besides probably Christ, which is probably a good thing. But so I'm curious, what was the impetus? Like, why was Vatican II this moment where the Church decided now's the time for us to start reaching out more to other religious groups? Like, what was it at that time that forced that change? Because I know, as someone who's Jewish, like, the in a lot of ways the Catholic Church is a model in the post-Vatican II world for a lot of the interfaith work, and organizationally has been more advanced than almost anyone else in kind of being in front of this.
And I know you're Ariel, a member of the Jewish community, and the relationship between Catholics and Jews changed fundamentally during the Second Vatican Council. And it was owing a lot, by the way, to scholars and rabbinical leaders that came from New York City who visited Pope John the 23rd, now considered a saint by the Catholic Church, St. John the 23rd, back in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And basically the message given to Pope John, and he in turn gave it to the Council Fathers, was, you know, we've had almost 2,000 years of estrangement and sometimes overt hostility. What can we do to build bridges to one another? And it gave us an opportunity to look at some of our texts, even our that were in our liturgy, that spoke disparagingly of Jews and of others. It also gave us an opportunity to really appreciate how deeply rooted we are in Judaism. Mm-hmm. That really, Jesus Christ, everything about the early church is unintelligible apart from an understanding of the Jewish roots. So that was a major, major shift and achievement. The famous document was In Our Age, called Nostra Aetate. Mm-hmm. Paragraph 4 dealt specifically with our appreciation, renewed appreciation of Judaism and the Jewish people. Now, looked at more globally, what was the reason for all this? Why build bridges to other religions, to other cultures? What had just happened? The Second World War, the Holocaust, the beginning of what was called the atomic age, the nuclear, the age of nuclear weapons of mass destruction.
Beginning of the Cold War.
The Cold War. You know, the world is in crisis. And if we're not able to speak to this crisis, then we're going to be very irrelevant as a religious community, as a religious voice. So we cannot do it alone. We have to join with others who are motivated by conscience and by their own religious convictions to address the roots of violence and war and poverty and global injustice. And now more recently, of course, especially with Pope Francis, the ecological crisis.
Climate change,
and et cetera. So how can we can't do it alone. We have to do it together in unison as women and men of religious conviction.
Right. So as a member of the Multifaith Advisory Council, we are constantly working on interfaith dialogue, but we tend to use the terms interfaith and multifaith interchangeably. And I know that you just went over that distinction and you're more in favor, if I'm not mistaken, of the term multifaith as a way of building bridges between religions. But is there a space for, I guess, like, worship together or learning more about other religions through that?
Yeah, it you touch on something that came up when Pope Francis came to New York City back in September, and he wanted to meet rather than in a mosque or a synagogue or an evangelical or even a Catholic church. He wanted to meet in a space that would be important for everyone. For all the religious communities represented here in our city. He also didn't want to favor any particular religious group.
Right.
So the invitation was extended by the 9/11 Museum to have the interreligious or multi-religious gathering at the museum And that, of course, is, in a way, it transcends religious distinctions. That is a space that is really sacred.
Especially for New York.
It's a cemetery, and it's for New York, in a very powerful way, it is. So in having it there, the question became, what kind of gathering, what kind of event would take place? Would there be interreligious prayer? Catholics are more familiar with the term interreligious or multi-religious rather than interfaith, multi-faith.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It has to do with some kind of theological distinctions that we make.
Right.
But we'll use both terms, you know, in a broader context. Interreligious prayer would suggest that we are praying together. Multi-religious prayer has the connotation of we are in the presence of the other praying.
Mm.
And the other is really the others. And it's not always possible for people of particular religious traditions to enter into prayer with those who have a very different concept of God,
mm-hmm.
a very different concept of, the human destiny and the meaning of human existence and what have you, all that informs the religious beliefs of a particular community. So multi-religious prayer is something that is more acceptable, broadly speaking. Where did this come about? It came about in 1986 when Pope John Paul II, the Polish Pope from behind the Iron Curtain, also now considered a saint within the Catholic world, John Paul II gathered religious leadership from all over the world to pray for peace. This was the Cold War was winding down at this point. And it was a very bold move. And he received quite a bit of criticism, even from within his own Catholic community. Some would say, how can you pray with a Buddhist who doesn't even have a concept of God or of a personal God?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that Buddhism is a very pluralistic and rich reality, and you'll find theistic and non-theistic strains of Buddhism. But it was a real question. And it fell to another future pope, Benedict XVI, at the time Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who explained this is really multi-religious prayer. It is respectful being present to the other while the other is communicating with the transcendent reality, with the supreme being, however she or he understands that to be. And we honor the tradition, we honor the person, we honor the form of prayer that he or she chooses. That's not the same as finding a common prayer that we can speak together, because that presupposes we have an understanding of what prayer is and the one to whom we're addressing the prayer, namely God. So multi-religious prayer is in some ways safer. It doesn't require that we check our religious beliefs, our convictions at the door before we enter into the the event.
I want to. You were mentioning actions taken by various popes, and I know that one of the things that I've really been struck by in starting this podcast and talking to different people, and this has come up in prior episodes, and it'll come up in another episode that we're about to release, is the diversity of people I'm talking to who have this universal love and admiration of the Pope. Especially this current Pope, the way he's been talking about refugees and climate change and poverty and just so many critical social issues. And to be honest, I've been jealous that I don't have a Jewish communal leader who has taken the mantle on some of these issues in the same way and who speaks to them with such humility and an authentic voice. And I'm curious, the Pope is not always a figure who is beloved in this moment. The Pope, kind of, some are more loved universally than others. So what has it meant, especially for the multi-faith work that you're doing, for the current Pope to be so admired? And what opportunities is that bringing up for all of us who kind of do this right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he took the name Francis, you know, who was a famous medieval saint, considered by many the patron of environmental stewardship and environmental activism. but was also someone who was very devoted to the poor. Francis did something that was quite unusual, quite radical in his day. We had monks who lived in monasteries and were great men and women of learning, convents and monasteries. And then you had the secular clergy who were the parish priests, those that took care of congregations. Francis took up this this new idea of being kind of a monk on the move. And he went to the streets, and he would tell the people in the parishes and the people in the towns and cities, look at the poor, look at the poor. Christ is in the poor. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. Famous words from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25. Francis was, he really kind of, he ruffled feathers. He got people kind of stirred up. Sometimes church authorities didn't know what to do with him. But he focused people's attention on the goodness of nature and the voice of the voiceless, the poor. This is a lot of what Pope Francis is doing.
Yeah. So he sounds like he picked the perfect name.
Well, he did. You know, a Jesuit who chose the name of the founder of the Franciscan order, you know, within those are two of the great famous religious orders. So he's, you know, Francis once said, St. Francis, to his brothers, to the friars, he said, preach always and use words when necessary. And the power of gestures is not to be underestimated on the part of religious leaders. And of course, great religious leaders know that. The Dalai Lama knows that. The, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. understood that, even though he was such a powerful orator. But gestures are really important. And Pope Francis is a master of communication through gestures.
Yeah.
There are just so many sermons he's given without saying a word, simply by reaching out to people. You know, when he walks into a room, he makes a beeline right for the disabled. You know,
there's been some great pictures of just such powerful images of that.
And it's not, you know, it's not anything scripted. It's just his attraction to people who are in need. You know, the gentleman who approached him maybe 2 years ago, who had a very debilitating and really difficult to look at skin disease. And so the man very humbly went up to the Pope and they began a conversation. But as the conversation was winding down, he just grabbed him and he kissed him on the forehead. It's gestures like that that are basically communicating to us, we have nothing to fear from the other. We have nothing to fear because there's a core of humanity that is present in all people. And so we first meet the other as a fellow human being, as a member of the same human family. And in that, he's being very faithful to the vision of the Second Vatican Council, which spoke a lot about the unity of the human family. So I think that maybe gets at some of why he is so...
It's very easy to talk about.
Yeah, he's so compelling a figure.
So I'm also, I wanted to ask, there's an incident from when he was here that my Imam Latif here has actually relayed and talked about with me numerous times. It made such a big impression on him. I was curious if you remember it. Apparently when the Pope was in New York, he was addressing a group of mostly Christian religious leaders, and Imam Latif was there, and he went off script and started talking about a death of many members of the Muslim world earlier that day, and completely unrelated, and went off script and spoke about it for a significant amount of time. And that type of care and compassion for others in an instance where it was almost like there was nothing to gain from bringing it up. It wasn't like he was surrounded by people who were Muslim and he was trying to empathize. It was really much different than that. That strikes me as, one, an incredibly unique feature for a religious leader, but also it seems to stem from, as you're saying, this genuine concern. Almost it's like perfectly made for the age in which we consume gestures and media, and that such quick, small sound bites and gestures are so readily deliverable to us and have such lasting impact that it's almost it's the perfect way to communicate a religious message nowadays, not just the perfect message to be communicating.
Well said. Yeah, no, what had happened, of course, Imam Latif was one of the 12 representatives that sat around the Pope on the stage at the 9/11 Museum for the inter-religious gathering, the multi-religious gathering. It was a powerful moment when he was there. Against the backdrop of the stage was the slurry wall that did not collapse when the towers fell, and that really holds back the Hudson River.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the waters of chaos. And I, you know, to me that was so significant because all of these religious leaders were there, and this is the conscience of men and women of our time that will hold back the chaos of violence and war and terrorism and everything that offends human dignity. So that was a very special moment. But Imam Latif was referring to the night before he was at St. Patrick's Cathedral for an evening prayer service with priests and nuns and religious and some lay leaders from the New York area, all Catholic. It was a Catholic gathering, and the Pope, he went off script. At the beginning of it, he said something terrible has happened in Mecca and Saudi Arabia.
People were like trampled during the Hajj, if I remember correctly.
And he said, "Now we need to take a moment of silence and pray for them." It was as if he was talking about members of the family. Members of the human family, reminding that the Catholic family, that they're part of a larger family. So it had a way, I think, of course, it touched the heart of an important Muslim leader in our city, and that's beautiful. But it was also just illustrative of something very important for Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we have to understand the importance of building those bridges to other faiths.
Yeah.
So as during Pope Francis's visit to New York, there was a sort of peace over the city. It felt as though, especially as a Catholic young woman, it was particularly a proud moment for me to be in Madison Square Garden to listen and to attend that mass. It was very special. But how do you see young Catholics emanating his message and carrying that beyond that week?
Yeah. It is, but I think, there's always something about young people having a capacity to recognize authenticity.
Always
they see through all, fakery, any masks that people put on or, equivocation. I mean, you see right through it.
Students are the quickest at that. Right, you can't fool them.
Cut right to the core. So here they encounter someone who is authentic. You know, he's genuine. He makes no bones about his own religious faith, his own tradition. He represents 1.2 billion Catholics around the world. I mean, that's his role as the successor of Peter, as the Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. But he also is a voice that does seem to transcend religious barriers, religious distinctions. Mm-hmm. And he's putting the question, I think, to all of us, to all of us who are on this journey through the early 21st century. What are we doing for the least of our brothers and sisters?
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing for the planet? This is an artifact of a benevolent creator, of a God who reveals his love to us through the things of nature. What does it mean for us to desecrate the environment?
Yeah.
You know, to emit all of these toxins into the air, into the waters. There's something blasphemous about it.
Yeah.
You know, there's something so highly offensive about it. It's offending God. You know, so he's putting those questions to us. Each one of us, he understands, has to kind of locate ourselves somewhere, either within a religious community, within a tradition, within a set of spiritual practices, mm-hmm. like yoga and what mindfulness
yeah.
training mm-hmm. and what you were talking about before. We all have to do that. And I think he has respect for everyone's journey. But the questions are universal. The questions are incumbent upon all of us to answer. What are we doing?
Yeah. And so we have a couple more minutes, and I want to, I would like to end at least with some sort of something very positive or a call to action. And it strikes me as what you're talking about now is almost the exact opposite of the current nature of American political discourse and just the sheer hatred and despicable things that people are saying as we gear up for a presidential election. And so as someone who's been doing interfaith for a long time and as someone who has been speaking to religious people of many different backgrounds for a while now and works with a church that is doing this, do you have maybe a quick message, sorry to put you on the spot, or something that you can say to people who are have religious or spiritual concern and who are looking forward to the next few years and thinking, what should I be caring about? What can I do? What can I do to help? What should that message be? What should we be focusing on?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a sort of salutary acknowledgement of the limits of politics.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a great devotee of St. Augustine, and Augustine was just, you know, one of the key figures in Western civilization, mm-hmm. Western culture. And he had a strong sense of the limits of politics. And that gets taken up by a lot of his, modern day devotees. Politics can't solve everything. We need religious communities. We need civic organizations, student groups, movements that are all focused on the issues, the key issues. And what are they? I think, poverty, peacemaking, peaceful conflict resolution, the second. The third would be the environment, mm-hmm. you know, the effects of climate change and how to in a sense depoliticize some of these.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're a Republican, Democrat, or whatever, just you got to see the science. You have to acknowledge the reality,
and we have to do something.
Right. So there's a more attention to the political rants and demagoguery than it deserves. Not to be discouraged or distracted by all of that, but to focus on the work, to focus on the importance of what we can do together across cultures, across religions, to address poverty, the need for peacemaking, and safeguarding the environment. Those are the three biggies that transcend religion, transcend culture.
Well, that's great. Three things I think definitely resonate a lot with our students. I see Andrea nodding her head. And we appreciate your time so much. And thank you so much for joining us. And we hope we can have you back at some point in the future.
Good to be with you, Andrea and Ariel. Thank you.
Thank Thank you to Bishop James Massa for joining us and for such an illuminating interview today. Also, thank you to Andrea, one of our amazing students here at NYU, for joining me on the interview. Special thank you to Brian Young, as always, for editing, producing the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we look forward to seeing you in another episode.